Hey, everybody. Welcome to my podcast, Cracking the Sky, Conversations with Creatives. I'm your host, Sydney Bullens. I'm here in East Nashville, Tennessee, where around every corner is a front porch, a songwriter, and a barking dog. On my podcast, I'm talking with a whole spectrum of creative people from around the world. I dig deep into what inspires these artists and creators to do what they do, and what it takes for them to make the leap into the creative unknown. I'm featuring some incredibly gifted people. Musicians, songwriters, artists, authors, record producers, actors, filmmakers, and more. I go inside the mainstream and outside the lines. So settle in wherever you are as we explore the process of making something out of nothing through the experience of some of the most creative people of our time. Hey, everybody. Welcome to the podcast. Today, I'm really, really happy to have a great friend, an old friend, someone who I super enjoy being with and talking to, Beth Nielsen Chapman, who is an incredible singer-songwriter and recording artist. I want to tell a little story first before I get her on. About how Beth impacted me like almost 25 years ago now. She and I met around Christmas time in 1994, not long after the tragic death from cancer of her first husband, Ernest. But before the death from cancer of my 11-year-old daughter, Jessie, in 1996. And within a month after Jessie's death, Beth called me on the phone. I was in Maine in my little island home, and she was in Nashville. I remember walking around my tiny little living room up there in that tiny little house with a phone in my hand as she spoke to me. I was completely and utterly devastated, of course, and overcome with grief, and I couldn't imagine doing anything creative again in my life. She proceeded to tell me that I would write again, that I would write beautiful songs about this unfathomable loss. No way, I thought. No way. She just kept talking to me about how I would write these songs that it would express the truth of what I felt and songs that would help me heal. I didn't believe her. I couldn't believe her. I remember her sending me a rough mix or some copy of her song, Sand and Water. The album, Sand and Water, her album, Sand and Water, didn't come out until 1997, but she sent me a work tape or a rough mix or something. And it became... Well, it still is one of my favorite songs on earth. And as time would have it, as the universe would have it, I wrote the song Somewhere Between Heaven and Earth a couple months after her call. And within that first year and a half after Jessie's death, I wrote the whole album Somewhere Between Heaven and Earth. And I credit her with that seed and the permission to write about my own grief. As most of my audience knows, writing those songs and what came after truly saved my life. So I know that's kind of a somber introduction, but it's the truth, and that's how important she is to me in my life. Twice Grammy-nominated Nashville-based Beth Nielsen Chapman has released 13 solo albums and written 7 number one hits. She's had songs recorded by such varied artists, those are my words, as Bonnie Raitt, Willie Nelson, Bette Midler, Elton John, Neil Diamond, Michael McDonald, Keb Moe, Roberta Flack, Waylon Jennings, Indigo Girls, And, of course, she had Faith Hill's mega hit, This Kiss, which was ASCAP's Song of the Year in 1999. And there's so much more. But right now, let's get to it. Yay! Finally!
Hey, we're here!
We're here. It's been a while, but oh, God, it's so great. I can see your face.
You and too.
The people are not going to see your face, but I'm very happy to see your face.
But see, they're going to
just across town.
They're going to hear us seeing each other's face, which is all going to be in our voice. So that's really good, you know.
No, important. It's great. You're just across town, but during the pandemic, it's like, you know, you might as well be in, you know, Timbuktu, but you aren't. You're here in Nashville. I'm on the east. You're on the south, I guess. South
of Nashville.
And Brentwood. But
what's fascinating, though, is that we can be connected to people in Denmark, like as if they're across the street. So
it's great.
That's been really good. You know, the rest of it's been for shit, but that's been really good.
I know. I'm counting my blessings, believe me. So, Beth, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you.
You are one of the busiest, most productive, most creative people I have ever known in my life, which is the truth. We've been friends, I don't know, for 25 years or something like that. And I'm still in awe of everything you do and everything you've done, because every time, you know, I either see it on Facebook or Instagram or, you know, and or I was like reading your bio and I'm like, wait a minute, when did she do that? Where is she now? Where is she going? I mean, you've got your friggin' world tour starting in
all around
in,
the world.
In, yeah, but the fall of 2021.
It hasn't happened yet. Those are anybody can type. You know, anybody can type. I always tell my son that, like, anybody can type. Who knows if it's true? Yeah. No, I think if I put it up there, it'll happen. So I'm moving into it. But no, I'm
all right. Well, I'm going to do that because I have no gigs booked, but I'm going to just make them up and put them on my website, and maybe they'll happen.
No, they will.
You know,
you don't even have to fill in the locations. It's just like Saturday night, I will be performing. I'll let you know about where and all that.
That's a great idea. I think I'm going to do that. You know, if you build it, they will come.
Absolutely.
Anyway, it's great. You've got the Christmas stuff around you, and you know, it's been there since July. I know that.
Yeah.
So
I have to have twinkle lights around me all the time, or I lose my mind.
It's true. And my wife made me put some up out in the back porch, those Fiesta lights.
Yeah, that's
you know,
good.
And
yeah.
So they're on all year and stuff like that. But that's nice. It's and you know, you walk into your house. Talk about creativity. I mean, your house is a house of creativity. You know, it's you walk in and everywhere you look in every single room.
Much to the horror of my husband, who would just as soon have like space. There are certain areas of the house I'm not allowed to go in without permission. You know, like I have to have a pass.
Like his room.
Anywhere in
like
the man
cave or something. Or
anywhere that the space is, you know,
tchotchkes
need not apply.
Yeah. So does he have a sign on the door that says, stop, do not enter?
He has a sign on the door that says, leave me alone. Yeah.
Go away. Leave me alone. I love that. Well, the podcast is called Cracking the Sky.
I love that title. I was so jealous when I heard that title. I thought, whoa, I wish I had a thought of that one.
So when I was thinking about creating this podcast, I thought, okay, this is what I'm doing. I'm doing it on creativity. Not that there aren't 100 podcasts on creativity, but I know my people. I have people who I know, I can tap
right.
to talk about the process of creativity, because I'm fascinated by creativity.
Yeah.
So we all started young. I mean, I know you started playing guitar and piano like around the same time I did, around 11 years old, you know, and there's a cute little story in your bio about how your mother hid a Framus guitar
in your closet
for your father for a Father's Day gift. So you found the guitar, obviously.
Yeah, I'd crawl in the closet, and all I had was one of those little round things with the you blow in the different, you know, it has the six tones so you can get it in tune. And I had we were living in Germany, so I didn't have access to like a music store or anything. So everything was in German. So I'd sit in the closet. And I would just get it in tune. And then I would put my fingers down on the strings in places that sounded good with each other. And then I had all these weird names for the chords. I was actually playing a D or a C or a G.
Yeah.
And sometimes in a very strange finger configuration. And then I would just name them like circle with a dot in the middle of it or X. And then as I got to be, you know, hanging out with folk players and, you know, Joan Baez, yeah, and yeah. Bob Dylan was all happening. This is like in the 60s. And
yeah.
And I just remember like walking up to somebody at a campfire and they'd be playing that thing that's a circle with a dot in the middle of it. And I'd say like that chord you're playing there that they'd go, you mean C? And I'm like, yeah, C. And I'd be like, write that down. You know, I mean, I didn't want anybody to know how illiterate I was, but.
Listen, that I still do that today. I mean.
I don't know the names of the chords. I don't know.
No. The I mean, I don't either. But that's the way I learned. I used to watch, and I'm a little bit older than you, and I used to watch Shindig and Hullabaloo in the 60s. And I would watch when they did the close-ups on the finger positionings.
Yeah.
Yeah. On the guitar, I would go back to the guitar with what I thought the finger positionings were and press up against the guitar until it sounded good. So same thing. But you started playing at about 11 years old. And so was that like it? Was it like a flash, like, oh, this is what I'm going to do? This is...
No, or was it, or did it was it never come like slower? What I was going to do to make a living, because I didn't have a concept of that, you know. Yeah. But I remember... just puttering around with it. And my parents would always rent a piano, and there was like musicians in my family. My uncle was a professional musician for many years, and he played all up and down the Atlantic coast and played in, you know, Atlantic City and casinos. And he had a great band, a fantastic singer, Rich Kelly and friends. In fact, they've got like YouTube videos and they've got a cult following back from the day. But
oh, how cool.
So I remember going in and hearing him when I was a kid, just thinking, oh my God, that's amazing. And, you know, my uncle Joe was a great piano player, but my parents always just had musical, like a piano was usually rented. So, and I failed piano lessons really badly, but around the time we lived in Germany, between 11 and 13, or right as I was turning 13, something happened to me that ignited me creatively and just made me realize this was going to be my life raft through life. Because when we were living in Germany, it was 1968. You know what a crazy year that was.
Mm-hmm.
Going on 69. And the last school field trip we had, the instructor decided it would be a really good idea to take us to Dachau, which is, wow, you know, concentration camp museum. And you know, 12-year-olds should not tour Dachau, period. I'm sorry. No. I don't care how smart they are.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
It totally wrecked me. I mean, I came home and got in the fetal position for a few days, missed some school. I just was so overwhelmed by what I saw. And I remember writing songs. And then I put away all my Barbie dolls. I was like, okay, the world is not a safe place. If anybody ever did that to people, they could do it again. I mean, my mind just went to like, what's happening now? And I remember coming home and saying, you know, what time does the news go on? You know, my mom is like, why are you watching the news? Go play with your Barbie dolls. I'm like, no. I got to find out what's happening with this civil rights thing and the Vietnam War. I mean, it's all bad, you know? And she was like, what? So when my dad got his orders, the next town we moved to was Montgomery, Alabama.
Oh my gosh.
And that was a real culture shock.
Wow.
It's come a long way. Now they have the Lynching Museum, which a real accomplishment. It's a really amazing thing that Montgomery has come far enough to actually have that there. So it's still got a ways to go, as we all know in general, but it just caused me to start writing songs that were anti-war songs that were really bad. But, you know, 12-year-old trying to write an anti-war song is not pretty. But I was passionate about pouring my feelings into the songs I was writing. And that kickstarted me. And I hung on to that guitar like a life wrapped, you know, through the rest of my life. I'm still hanging on to it, and a piano occasionally.
Yeah. What a story.
But I think I was meant to be, because when we moved and then we were living in Montgomery and I was trying to adapt to, you know, that culture. And I mean, I literally wrote my way through my teenage years, probably kept me off of any serious drugs. And, you know, that became my go-to medicine. You know, creativity.
So did you start writing songs in Germany before you came back?
Yeah.
So at like 12, 13 years old.
Yeah. I mean, I started writing when I was 11. I started writing.
Yeah.
The first songs I wrote when I was 11 and, you know, in the closet before I came.
Everybody's in the closet.
All like puppy dog somewhere. Tales and happy songs and flowers and, you know, I was rhyming bees and knees and, you know, clouds and wouds. And but then when I got inundated with this awareness of the world not being a safe place, it just shifted my need to write songs turned out to be an outlet for my fear and my worry and thinking that's not fair. They shouldn't be hosing those people down and setting dogs on them. And I'd write a song about, you know, that as if I knew what it felt like to be a Black person in the South.
Yeah.
But it was just my exercise for my own sanity, really. And then as I got older and all the things in my life happened, of course, that was set in stone. My relationship to creativity, I want to back up a little bit because it started before that. I was really blessed with parents who really, you know, were very, very happy to see their kids be creative. And they never like critiqued me, you know, so I could bring my mom a stick with a ball of mud at the end of it and go, I made this for you. And she'd be like, oh, this is just so beautiful. Oh my God. Look, honey, look at what Bethy made me. Look, isn't that beautiful? What is it? You know, I mean, she was always, yes, keep doing that. You know, and my dad was the same way. And I know that a lot of kids get shut down by their siblings or their, you know, and I managed to get almost all the way through my childhood, not knowing that anything I could ever create wasn't just great. I got battered later on in life plenty.
Yeah, but
it was really such a lovely golden years of expressing myself. I painted and I sculpted and I played with all sorts of ways to create. And I never had somebody try to shut me down and say, oh, you shouldn't be doing that, you know. But as I...
So great.
Yeah. And as I came into being older and I started getting in the music business, of course, I had the rejection that everybody else goes through. And that was kind of shocking to me. In fact, my first album came out in 1980 and Barry Beckett produced it. And it was, you know, all the Muscle Shoals guys played on it. It was supposed to be a massive success. I mean, everything else had been working out great for me right up to that point. And then right as it came out, disco hit. So nothing really took off with my album. Plus, I wasn't really ready for prime time anyway. But when I didn't have immediate success, I just blamed it on I just took it really personally. And I didn't write for almost 5 years. And then I got married and had a baby. And I was just pouring all my creative energy into anything but songwriting because it was too painful to me to put myself out there again and then have nobody care. So it took me a long time. It took me... The short version is I ended up seeing Coal Miner's Daughter. And there I was watching Loretta Lynn with kids climbing all over her, planting potatoes so they don't starve, writing, you know, The Pill and these great songs that became iconic. And I thought, I'm sitting there in the movie theater thinking, I'm really being a big baby about this stuff, you know? I'm being a baby. So I just ended up going back into writing and then eventually moved to Nashville. And so my relationship with creativity was always fairly strong. And when I didn't feel creative for writing songs, I would be supplanting it with making Play-Doh heads or, you know, doing other things, making a mobile for my baby's nursery. You know, I could not be creative, but when I teach about creativity, which is something that I'm really passionate about, the first time I ever got asked to teach, it was in the early 90s, and Pat Pattison from Berkeley in Boston, who you probably have met, great teacher, great professor of music. You know, he invited me to come to Berkeley and to teach for a week, like a residency, because I'd had two big hits on the radio. I had a song called Strong Enough to Bend, which was a big hit for Tanya Tucker that I wrote with Don Schlitz. And then I think I wrote a big hit song for Willie Nelson that went to number one. And so he had taken a couple of my songs apart. Actually, they were songs from my album that I just put out on Warner Brothers. And he had dissected them in a book that he wrote on lyric writing. And so he called me and said, look, I've featured you in this chapter. I've been teaching about your songs. Would you come and do a week of teaching? And I thought, sure. I mean, how hard can it be? You know, I'll just talk about what I did or something. Yeah. I don't know. I didn't have a thought in my head. I just said, yeah, I'll take the job. So he flies me up there a couple of weeks later. And of course, I'd been really busy and I hadn't really looked at the book that he sent me. And I was just kind of, and then I, on the plane, I'm reading the chapters where he took my songs apart and butterflied them and showed everybody and I'm using quotation marks here, mm-hmm. what I was doing when I wrote those.
Yeah, books. Yeah.
And I was reading this book, breaking out in a sweat, because I was realizing I've just been hired to talk about this stuff like that. You know, like, I didn't know I did any of that. I never heard of automatopoeia or whatever that's called.
Yeah, no, it's like the circle with the dot, you know.
Yes, exactly. And he was expecting me to be able to talk, I thought, on this really knowledgeable level. And I knew I was an imposter. So I walked into the class, 350 kids, Berkeley kids, you know, really.
I'm shaking my head for those of you out there.
And they're smart. They're smart. And they all know all where all the bodies are buried in the songs that they've looked at that I wrote. But I don't know where the bodies were buried. So I walk in, I said, Pat, you're not even going to have to pay me because I'm going to suck at this because I just read the chapter in your book and I didn't know I did any of that. He goes, tell them that. Yeah. Tell them. So I went up to the microphone. And I said, I'd like to start off with a full confession. When I wrote those songs that you have now looked at so specifically, here's how I did it. I started off with a chord and then I made a sound and I went, and I made up some words and I didn't know what I was doing. I want you to know that most of the time that I was writing that song, I did not know what I was doing. And then at the very end, I analyzed what I had so far and I moved some parts and pieces around and I did sort of an editing thing, which is different than the writing thing, which comes from the creative flow and the collaboration that we have with this thing that is not inside of us. It is outside of us and it works with us.
That's what I want to talk about. That's what I want you to elaborate on.
Yeah.
Because, and so if I can stop you there, because, mm-hmm. because that's the thing that's with me too. I have never been to school. I don't know. I still don't know half the chords I play. And you know me, I've been doing this for a long time and I write from a certain place in me, but that's what I want to hear about is what is that relationship with the brain and whatever else that is?
Well, I think of my brain as my hard drive. I think of my brain as the working mechanics of my computer. Mm. And I think of my brain stores the experiences that I've had in folders somewhere. Some of them are hidden, some of them I can read. And sometimes I don't even know how I feel about certain things until I start to write about them. And I start with a sound. It's my voice or the guitar or some combination of the two. The first time I'll sort of blah, blah, blah into a melody, I don't even care if it makes any sense. I just want to find out where the vowels like to be. So even as I finish a song, sometimes 2 years after I started it, if I go back to that first work tape, the very first time the melody fell out of my mouth, the vowels are already in place.
Mm-hmm.
And 2 years later, the line I wrote a year and a half after that, I didn't say I've got to match the vowels. I didn't even think about it because in my experience, the songs are written and they kind of come up through these layers. Sometimes it's faster, sometimes it's slower. But I have learned to trust that I'm not writing the song by myself. And, you know, I feel like I think of creativity as air. I think of it as this is all around us. It's in every crevice it can fit in, right? And it's got oxygen in it, right? And we're humans and we have to breathe oxygen. So if I'm sitting in a room with you, if somebody says to me, you're more creative than I am, that's like somebody telling me, you have more air available to breathe than I do. Mm. But if I'm sitting in a room with that person, we have the same amount of air available to breathe. Mm. So it is not whether or not you have creativity. It's whether or not you are open to creativity.
Yes.
And that's,
I love that.
That's the magical, you know, perspective that I've found for people who are stuck or never felt like they had a right to be creative or never felt like they had the thing. Mm-hmm. Like when somebody says, oh, she has so much talent, it makes me crazy because talent is only realized opportunity. It's not whether or not you have talent. It's whether or not you've realized your inborn talent, which is just like saying, oh, she's got such a body. You know, like, well, I don't know. What does she look like? Does she look like she's taking care of her body or, there's so many ways that definitions shut us down. So I feel like, you know, in my bio, it says I'm a creativity whisperer, kind of like a horse.
And a creativity midwife too.
Yeah, I do that too. And it's just because I want to coax a person's belief system out of the mud into a place where they can see. I want to convince them that you can open those long closed doors. You can open up a space and you can do a practice to do this. And I teach this in my workshops, and it's like, there's a lot of things, little tricks and stuff that you can do, but showing up is the first thing you have to have. You have to have the show up muscle, right? So if you don't show up to begin the process, nothing's going to happen. And sometimes you show up and you're completely closed down, but you're there, you're sitting in your chair. And I'm like, good, we got that sorted. So that's the first thing. And then we're going to talk about play. And play is the greatest key to getting your brain to take a hike.
Play is a very, very important word because it's all encompassing. It's that word. It's like press the button and play the song. It's playing on the jungle gym. It's playing music. It's play. And to me, that's a really important word, because if I play at making music, I'm much more available to the music coming in than if I define it as work.
Yeah. And so much of the time when we are playing, we are not even aware that what we're blathering about is even good. I mean, I wrote Sand and Water not even knowing, as I wrote down this line, which I think is one of the most amazing lines that ever came through me, which is a line that says, solid stone is just sand and water and a million years gone by. I remember writing that down and going, well, that doesn't make any sense, but I'll fix it later. You know, I was completely not getting it, you know, and I wrote it down, you know.
No, that song. And by the way, let me just stop right there, because that song, which we're going to play in the podcast a little bit, but that song to me is one of the most profound songs ever written by anybody. And I have my own story about that, but we'll talk about that. And that line, you're right. It's a line that you go, what? What?
Yeah.
But it, and you don't even know sometimes, like you say, what it really means, but it's something. It means something. It hits somebody somewhere.
Yeah. And it's like a line, like I always use the example of the kind of line that's like, she wore diamonds in the soles of her shoes. You know, like that is just an amazing.
Or I can drink a case of you and still be on my feet.
Yeah. Yeah. But those lines, wherever they come, whatever writer is writing them, they're not writing that from thinking it up. I can guarantee you it's popping through like bleh. It's like, it's effortless when those lines come through, and then you write them down and you go, oh, that's pretty good, you know? And even when I've co-written, and I mean, I was one of the writers on a song called This Kiss for Faith Hill, which was a big hit.
Right.
Helped put my son through college. And I wrote it with Annie Roboff and Robin Lerner. And, you know, we had this chorus that was really good. I mean, they wrote a lot of the chorus before I even got involved. And then it ended up with this kind of like, your critical kiss. It was like this little kind of pat thing at the end. And I'm like, God, it just needs to be shouting from the rooftops, you know, like this kiss, something like that. And then I just sort of threw that out there, and they were like, yeah, that's good. I went, oh, that is good. Yeah. I mean, but it's like when I said it, I didn't think. So I try to teach people how to get their brains kind of a little bit more on the back burner until you can get all the raw material from the other side of the creative flow.
Right.
And I think of creative flow as this. It's basically God breathing. God is breathing into everything that will allow creativity to flow. And the beauty of it is it doesn't interrupt. So if you have a plant and you plant a seed and then you put a cup over that thing, it's not going to push through the porcelain of the cup. You know, you have to work with it. You have to allow for. We interact with how much are we going to create? Are we going to build? Are we going to make a garden? Or are we going to mow the lawn? Or, you know, and I think of God breathing through every single thing that is moving through creativity. And that includes if you leave your cheese sandwich on the piano and you come back in 3 weeks, creativity will have happened. Unless it's Velveeta, which is not actually a food. But mold is creativity, you know, like you can't. If you go away and you come back in 6 months, there'll be a layer of dust on everything.
Yeah.
You know, if everything that you, let's say I say, come on, sit in this chair. We're going to write a song. Don't be afraid. And you are like, I'm not going to be able to do this. I suck. I don't have a right to say, nobody cares what I have to say. What all those voices that we can have in our head that stop mm-hmm. us from feeling ready to be creative. And those actual voices in our head take up, there's this hole in the top of your head and it's where all the flow comes through. And it's actually, it takes up the real estate. You know, you can't be saying I suck and having creative flow at the same time. So I have all these tricks. Like I'll say to somebody, look, just when you go to your little space, your little creative space, just bring a pot of tea and then bring some cups and bring a cup for your fear that you suck. Put it over there. Give it a People magazine. Take another cup. You know, your fear that nobody will ever care what you have to say. You know, like all the little parts of you, the part of you that wants to quit writing way too early and go eat lunch or watch Netflix or some, you know, scroll the Insta, you know, like give that part of you a little cup of tea. I pour little cups of liquid all around my studio if I have to. And then I just go, you guys, interrupt me as much as you like, because if you tell those other voices to stop talking to you, the energy that it takes to try to stop them
right.
also stops the flow. So you have to go, everybody feel free to join in. Mm-hmm. Don't take it personally if I don't respond, because I'm going to be over here writing my freaking song. Okay. or sitting here waiting for my song to happen.
Right. Right. So I love that. Yeah.
So in that space of just cracking it open just a little bit, then I have to let them know. And you might do all those things right. And it's possible that nothing will happen. Like mm-hmm. you won't write yesterday, or, you know, like you won't write your opus that day.
Right.
So then you go, oh, I suck. Oh my God. See, I knew I sucked because I did all those things. But you can't open that. You can't create that opening with a stipulation. If the stipulation is I have to now have an experience of creativity that's going to be fulfilling and I'm going to feel good about it, and then that means I got this right, that's actually not going to work either. So I have to make another allowance for, and if you show up and you just open up and just be willing to not know what you're doing and allow yourself to putter, play, hit a few chords, be as easy and forgiving as you possibly can to whatever comes through. Keep the recorder on, because just in case you're brilliant and you don't recognize it, you'll have that. Yeah. And then if you sit there for half an hour and you don't really feel that excited about what you came up with, and you're kind of thinking maybe that was a waste of time, then you have to think, no, actually, I just worked out. I just lifted 3,000 pounds in the gym of creativity. And I'm working a muscle, and my muscle is the show up and be ready muscle. And I promise you, if you do that with some regularity, you will not be able to not write.
Yeah.
You won't be able to not write. And even if it doesn't happen in that moment, when you go downstairs and try to fix some soup or go to the store, the whole thing will start barreling through you because you have invited it and you're letting it know, I'm here. I'm going to show up. I'm going to be ready. So I'm just around, you know, and then it'll start to flow. I've never seen it not work to happen.
And that's why songwriters or writers or any creative person, but writers in particular, have notebooks and notebooks and notebooks of one line titles. You know, I have work tapes from 1977 in my basement cassettes, you know, and I have a cassette player, and I keep, you know, for many years, I keep threatening to bring up those work tapes and put them in, you know, because I have written more songs with something I wrote 10 years before, a title that I put down 10 years before, or a line, or even a lick, because if the lick wants to be written, a musical lick,
right,
it'll stay there.
Yeah.
It'll be there like for years until I have this instrumental song that I wrote in Dadgad that I wrote like, I don't know, 5-6 years ago, have not been able to find lyrics for it. I know what I wanted to say. I cannot find the lyrics for it. But that instrumental
is not going anywhere.
has got to be written at some point. And every once in a while, I'll start playing it and see if something else comes up.
Yeah.
So I guess I'm not supposed to write it by myself, but
well, you never know. I mean,
all right, I'll be over as soon as the pandemic's done.
Yeah. There you go.
So let me ask you this though, in terms of, because you're talking about the brain being a computer, and you've talked about opening up, and you've talked about the hole in the top and all of that stuff. I totally get it. You know, I think as creators, we might express it in different ways, but all of those pathways mm-hmm. resonate with me, you know, and actually I'm listening like, oh, this is good. I'm going to try.
I got lots of tricks.
But in terms of when it happens to you, not how you're trying to tell somebody else, but when it happens to you, is that feeling of, how does it go through your body? I mean, I know you said your brain is a computer. Do you get a visceral response, like a physical response when you write?
The funny thing about me is I will write some of the stuff that I will end up thinking is the best stuff I ever wrote, like Sand and Water. You would think that as I wrote that song, I'd be like, oh my God, this is so great. I'm just writing a great song right now. This is going to be a song that goes around the world and helps people for 20 years. And all that's true, but I was completely oblivious. So I think I have the opposite of a visceral response. Mm. I think when I really am in the zone, I'm actually not in the center of the address of Beth.
Right.
I'm not in my center. I'm actually in my center, but there's this allowance of, here's what it feels like. If I were going to describe it, it's like there's the core of my center, and then there's a way that I kind of expand. And then in the middle of that, there's this entrance of another kind of information train that brings me words that even sound like the words that are going to end up being the words that aren't even like, they don't even make sense yet, but I go ahead and write them down, you know?
So you're like channeling, or you're the vehicle.
It is like channeling, but I think channeling. And then I'm not.
Yeah.
So the hard work comes, that part's all really fun, you know, like, woo, and I get to play and sing. And then I go back and I listen to what just happened. And when I listen, I put on a different hat. I put on the editor and the analyzer hat. And those are really important skills. That this is the stuff that Pat Pattison was teaching to those kids when they took my song apart. And they said, here's why this works so well, because this thing here, and then that sets that up. And it's a logical, it's a craft. It's a study of an art form. Those are fantastic things to learn how to know more about as a writer. It won't give you the clay, the raw material, as much as getting a good night's sleep, meditating, and, you know, eating well and digesting a lot of great literature and poetry. That will make your output as a creative person much better. But being able to take what you've written and now go take a little break, come back with your coffee, look at it, go, that first verse is really strong. Second verse could be better, blah, blah, blah. So like when I critique a song in a workshop, or if you played me a song and I was going to give you some feedback, I would be listening with that hat that's like, let's see if it'll go through the sieve of, who's talking to who about what? And, you know, do I understand what this song is about? What's it communicating to me? Is it moving me? Is it telling me something?
Yeah.
All those things. And sometimes it can be a song that's really kind of an impressionistic painting. It doesn't have to be nail on the head, you know? So there's all different, there's a huge variety of, as long as the song works, it can be a whole bunch of things. So getting the song airtight is a whole process of really fine tuning and going line by line and then playing it for somebody like Rodney Crowell and like, is this done yet? You know, and bouncing it off on another writer or looking at it the next day with fresh ears. So though that process, sometimes I'll come the next day and I'll go to bed that night and I'll go, man, I just wrote the best song. It's so perfect. It's just so great. And I'll wake up the next morning and I'll look at it and go, ew, there's like a lot of work I got to do on this thing. So I don't think I can be the same person at all the stages of dress that a song goes through.
No, I get that.
Every once in a while, you know, I'm sure you've had it happen where the whole thing just falls through in 20 minutes and it's all written.
Rarely, but yeah, it'll happen. Yeah, exactly. That's a big thank you moment. Thank you. And I guess the visceral thing for me, and I think you helped me clarify my question, was because when I teach, I talk about what moves you. Like a song has to move you. It can move you in 15 ways. It could be the beat, it could be the lyric, it could be the music, it can be the emotion, it can be whatever it is, but in some respect it has to move you. And I think it has to move me first. I have to be moved, and that's what I think I was asking about, the visceral part of it, you know, not the right word.
I think when I'm actually writing something, I have no idea, but I have usually convinced myself that it's good. Because I have to kind of get excited. I mean, I get excited about it. Even, you know, 6 months later, if I look back at it and go, that's a really good song and that's a great song. And I might not have even known the difference when I was writing the two songs. So I think I really do kind of become absent from the part of me that would judge where it is, you know, if it's this or that or better or worse, kind of pulls back. And I try to make that happen because there's this incredible thing when you're very forgiving in the first half of the writing process where you just take all the lines, take all the funny words. When I co-write with someone, I said, there's no such thing as being stupid. You know, like there's nothing that's stupid. Mm-hmm. Let me hear every word that's coming through your mouth, because that is often a clue. Cause I think the song is already completely perfectly written.
Right.
We're downloading it in segments or layers. A lot of times when I write with Annie Roboff, we've written a bunch of stuff together. She'll be playing a melody and she'll be just singing those nonsense words.
Yeah.
And I'm
I do that too.
You know, I'm hearing something in that that's going to end up being the line. And she'll sit there and go, well, I don't really write that many lyrics. I go, yes, you do. You really make it easy for me to hear what the lyrics want to be. And it's very subliminal. Again, it's getting out of the way of the thing. But the fine tuning part, you know, I read something recently in something Mary Gaucher, I think, wrote, where she said there's a big difference between the editor and the critic. And the editor is a very important, useful part, but you don't want to edit before you've got enough to work with. Like, so I try not to edit at the front part. In the middle part, I edit, or I'll go, well, this part's working. And I have this, like, for instance, with a lot of songwriters, they've worked really hard on a song and they don't want to give up any of the verses. And I'm like, okay, but the second verse, let's just lift it out of the song. We're going to put it over here to the left of me. I have this thing I have prepared for myself that I suggest that you prepare for yourself in your writing. It's called the altar of things that aren't going anywhere.
Huh.
And I suggest you get whatever your deity of choice is, Jesus, Buddha, whatever you love of the spirit world, put it on up there, get some candles, some incense, pretty tablecloth, deck it out in your brain. And then when you're working on the editing part of your song, be willing to go in there with your pith helmet and your pickaxe, carve out the parts that aren't as great, okay? Mm. Put them on the altar of things that aren't going anywhere. And now you have a lovely hole in your song. And do you know what creative flow absolutely loves is a void?
Yep.
Because if you've been to, you know, if you just went to Berkeley for 6 months and you were, you know, you got a scholarship, and then you went to the class and all they talked about was all this picky, picky stuff about why this song is perfect and why that song is perfect. And you're all perfected out and your brain is so full of new information and you haven't written for 6 months because you're just a mess and you don't know if you've even got it anymore because it's just so hard and there's so many things to remember. And how did Beth write those songs? Oh my God, they're so brilliant. And then Beth is standing in front of you and she gets up on the microphone and she says, I want you to know that when I wrote that song, I did not know what I was doing. And then you burst into tears of joy and relief. And that's what happened with three little girls right in the front.
Aww.
They just were so relieved that they didn't have to know all that.
So, okay, here's a question, and it wasn't on my list, and we're not talking about anything on my list, and that's just fine.
We know we're going on the magical mystery tour.
Yeah, and it's all good, and because I only have them in case anyway, but I knew I wouldn't need anything with you. But, you know, so there's the difference between talent, and you've already talked a little bit about that, and how to do something. So the craft, I guess.
Right.
So in my experience, the craft of writing has been about my experience of just keeping doing it, you know, and observing and listening to other people's stuff. I never went to school. I can't read music. I don't know any of that stuff. And not to say that any of that's bad, but, you know, when I was thinking halfway through my career that I would go to music school, I had people say, don't do it, you know, don't go now because,
I think that music school can get a bad name because it can be just kind of a little bit one-sided. And I mean, I think Pat Pattison is one of the great, great teachers because he does that so brilliantly, the whole critique part of it. And yeah, he has amazing, amazing teaching things he's, created over the years. You should have him on your show. He's fantastic. But, you know, I try to get people back to that childlike place.
Right.
Of the blank white piece of paper that, guess what? When Bob Dylan writes his next song, he's got the same thing on his plate that you do, which is a blank white piece of paper. And having that catalog hanging over your head is not a plus. Let me tell you.
Which he just sold. So.
Right. So, but I mean, he's got this whole body of work that he could try to live up to, or just, you got to be childlike and start from that place of scratch. But the thing that is really powerful about being able to switch hats is that the craft, I think you can go to music school as long as you maintain your relationship with that childlike part of creativity, which I'm always preaching about, that people tend to lose or they don't think they ever had it. That's the part that really breaks my heart, where somebody says, I'm not really talented, but like, if you're breathing, you're just as capable of reaching the places where this experience is. Mm-hmm. Now, whether or not you've learned the craft, like, you might be, oh my God, I just wrote this thing. And then you play me something and it's not finished, but it's really inspiring and it's got legs, but it's not done. Mm-hmm. And it can be very difficult for writers that are just finally getting there, you know, into the joy of it. And then I come along and go, now I want you to take out that second verse and move that around and move that around and then fill that in. And that's terrifying to them. And that's why I try to make it fun, like putting things on the altar of things that aren't going anywhere. Mm-hmm. It's a good way to not feel like you have to lose it. And if it ends up back in the song, fine, you know, but give yourself a chance to go out past your comfort zone. And then that thing where you can, like you said, you know, you listen to music. Well, while you were listening to music, your amazing computer brain was making notes, like, oh, and that's interesting because that's why that works. And so you're writing your own book on lyric writing. You're filling it in as you listen to music and absorb it and live with it and you let it own you. And that is what you bring when you shift from, okay, I've got this thing, it's all inspired. Now I'm going to look at it analytically and see what needs to be different or better. Then, when you have the hole in your song, I want people to throw all that away. Take that hat off. Good God, don't try to fill in those blanks with the critique guy or the editing guy. That's like going to suck. What I want is, let's go back to the childlike swing set and just swing in. And that's how I write the second half of the song, is I'll be like, sing up to it and then go blah, blah, and see what falls out of my mouth and try to get back to that innocent childlike play, that word again, play, you know, to play is to invite the you don't know yet into the dance. You don't know what it is yet, you know. And I tell people, I say, look, when you come to my workshop because you want me to teach you how to, so you can know how to write a song, I said, you're going to want your money back, because basically I'm going to teach you how to be comfortable not knowing what you're doing, because that's where all the good stuff happens, when you don't know yet and you're just about on the edge of what you know and you're hanging one foot over and you don't have anything to put your foot on yet, and something comes along and goes right under your foot. It will do that. I've had it happen so many times. But you can't, it's an uncomfortable place for a lot of people. I don't know why. I don't know.
Well,
why.
It's a fear of it's that unknown thing. I mean, everybody wants to feel grounded and knowledgeable and, you know, I can do this and all that stuff. And I think that's the thing about creativity itself, is that, as I say in my intro, we're creating something out of nothing.
Period. Love that line. I love that line in your intro.
We're creating something out of nothing. Right. And it, whether you're, you know, growing a garden, planting a seed, or writing a song, or painting a painting, or writing a book, whatever, or making dinner.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, yeah, you've got things that you're putting in the pot to make the stew, but you start with nothing. You got to go to the store first and get the ingredients, you know, so we're all making something out of nothing. And that's what's so fascinating to me.
Absolutely.
Well, we've talked about it and you've talked about it, you know, and so that's the fear. Right. You know, I'm sitting here, I've got a keyboard over here. I've got three guitars over there, you know, but I have stuff to do. I have stuff to do before I have to do my taxes. I have to, you know, vacuum the cat hair off the rug. I have to, you know, go for a walk because I have to exercise today. You know, whatever it happens to be, before I sit down and go,
yep, yep,
with nothing, that blank page, that blank thing. Right. And that's the fear. But you've already explained how you encourage people to allow, and I think that's a big word, let and allow. We have to let that, yep, whatever it is, whatever, yep, it is. And sometimes it's inspiration and sometimes it isn't.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I'm not always inspired to write. You know?
I mean, you can just, but the thing is, it's like a relationship. So if you've been married for a certain number of years, sometimes you just don't jump on top of each other and tear each other's clothes off anymore. But in order to have a very rich sex life, there are things that you do to nurture and to give the opportunity for things to sort of happen that maybe you weren't even thinking about. That.
Okay. So we're into
now that you started kissing me on the back of the neck, maybe.
Okay. So you want to make sure I've got to put a note in the podcast that says, you know, around 50 minutes in, you want to tune in because she starts talking about sex.
That's right. I mean, Shelley Piken has a great blog that she calls it song sex. When you co-write with someone, it's like you're going into a place, a very intimate place with another human. You might not have ever met them before that day.
Yeah.
So, I mean, to me, the relationship that you have with your creative flow, I think of it as somebody that's like almost a being that's like a thing that I can show up for it. I can ignore it. I can have it practically pour itself into the top of my head when I'm just trying to get the grocery store done, mm-hmm, and all different things. But it is something that is worth nurturing. It's worth consciously creating a regular date with. Like, I make a date with myself to write. I make a date with myself to just play. I don't even have to say I have to write a song. I'm just going to 10 minutes a day, I'm going to plunk around on the piano. I might play Mozart or I might play something I'm working on. And then before you know it, half the time, something will just start writing through me. And if I didn't do that in a casual, no pressure way, I might miss out on a lot of ideas and things that come through, you know?
Yeah. I love that about you and I envy you that. And because I keep myself away from it sometimes, but
also understand that. I do understand, yeah, that because I don't, naturally, it's like getting on my elliptical machine. It's right there. It'll, yeah, take 2 seconds. Just once I get my legs like to,
yeah,
I do three of these, I'm like, I love, yeah, this. This is, yeah, why don't I do this every day? That's the weird thing about it. I don't understand, yeah, why I even have my own resistance to it. I don't understand that.
Yeah.
But it's kind of like, you know, when you go on a juice fast and you start feeling really good after like 2 days, you're like, why am I eating all that crap? You know, and then before you know it, you're back to eating the crap. So
yeah,
we deal,
yeah,
with that, you know, as humans, yeah, but I feel like it's just, there's so much hope for people to enrich their lives. And I, you know, I tell people about, you know, do your body of work in your life. It can be bread baking for 1 year, maybe painting,
exactly,
next year. Writing songs, you know, you can come to my workshop never having written a song and you might, mm-hmm, find out you absolutely love it, you know?
Yeah.
And if you,
yeah,
don't, you'll find out that you can be creative in another way that you will love. And
well, that's the thing about creativity. And I totally agree with you because I encourage people to do something, mm-hmm, creative, anything that, and
I'm going back to that word visceral, but it isn't, maybe it isn't visceral, but it's the flow, that thing, like you talk about opening up your head and letting it come through you. But if we stop ourselves from the natural flow of whether it's spiritual or, you know, with a small s, you know, or whatever it is, then we aren't living our fullest lives here.
I mean, think about, like, if you found a journal, or you found an acetate from your great-great-grandfather of a song they wrote, that they just wrote because they wanted to write a song, it would be a treasure. It would be absolute right. treasure to have that. And all of the chicken scratchings of all the humans that left a trail of what their experience was, that's what we call art. I mean, art is this thing where you walk in a museum and you look at these renderings of human experience brought into color and field and dimension and beauty and smells. And I mean, mm-hmm. all the senses, art lives in all the senses. So
right.
we are in the sense of the audio, you know?
Yeah.
But I mean, I've seen people, I mean, I feel audiences shift and change, and I'm sure you have felt this too, because you've written those kind of songs. I know, you know, the song you wrote for your daughter is just one of the beautiful songs of going through grief and loss. And I mean, you know, that thing where you sing that song, you wrote it for yourself. You didn't write it to save the world or help other people, but it is helping other people because you mm-hmm. are resonating this experience that you went through. That's just unspeakably impossible to put into words. And you did. And so they feel that connection. And even if they haven't lost a child or haven't lost a loved one, they feel that resonating, and they know nobody gets out of this world without going through some kind of loss like that. And they are,
right.
they're filled. It's the nutrition of us to give to each other. We are feeding each other and saving each other with right. what we create. And it sounds really lofty when I say that. This has nothing to do with fame.
No, nothing.
Well, in fact, you know, I use Van Gogh all the time, because what if Van Gogh had said, well, nobody's buying my paintings. Yeah. Why would I be bothering? I mean, this is such a drag, you know? I mean, if he had that attitude, he painted because he had to paint, you know?
Listen, I have one of my songs, The Lights of Paris, from the album Somewhere Between Heaven
that.
And Earth.
I love that.
You know, which Rodney co-produced, and Rodney Crowell.
Yeah.
And it talks about Vincent Van Gogh. And the line in the song is, I stood in a room full of Vincent Van Gogh. Mm-hmm. I couldn't tear myself away, struck by light and color, pure genius on display. Well, he never knew he was a genius. He never knew that he would have a room in the Musée d'Orsay and other rooms in every museum, you know, and be taught in every class and stuff like that.
And maybe on some level within himself, he did know he was a genius, but he never got anybody helping him, like supporting that.
Right.
You know,
right.
His life was really hard trying to exist in a world there where he had to render this beauty, but didn't have a lot of support for it. So, I mean, you can't, it's hard to be creative even when, you know, even when things are going well, it's hard to show up. And I say that it's not hard to show up, but it's something we, for some reason, I think collectively humans just sort of think, well, I think I'm just going to watch another Netflix and maybe I'll do that tomorrow. There's a kind of laziness that we can easily fall into. And that's why I try to just get people to, like, make it really simple. 5 minutes of the showing up and then plunk around. And then sometimes that'll turn into 2 hours, because once you get on the thing, you feel good.
Yeah. That's what I say in the beginning is, you're one of the most productive people.
But that's funny that you say that because I don't feel productive. I feel like I'm constantly behind and I never get what I want to do done. And
well, that's,
I'm always bitching and moaning about.
You're crazy. You're absolutely out of your mind.
Like, I'm doing a lot of stuff. You know, anyone can type.
Anyone can type. Okay. I'm going to use that.
Yeah.
Well, speaking of what you're doing, you're not behind. You just recorded a new record, which I had the honor of singing on.
Yes, you sang one of my favorite songs on there.
So when's that coming out? What's the name of it? What's going on with it?
I don't know the exact name of it. I've named my world tour the All Around the World Tour, which one of the songs I wrote with Graham Gouldman is called All Around the World. And I work with Ray Kennedy, as you know. He has done a fantastic album with you. And you know, all the great stuff. He's just a genius.
He's a great old friend and co-producer.
So I'd never done an album the way that we did this record. It was so much fun. And I really kind of got tricked into getting out of my own way in a way that I never have done. So, you know, I consider myself a pretty good singer. So when I'd make my records, I would, you know, do the vocal and capture the vocal with the tracking thing. But often I'd come back and I'd sing it and then re-sing it and, you know, have it all get right. And Ray World, it was
like, I know Ray World, all,
great band he put together, fantastic band.
Yeah.
And then just playing with that band was like, they made me think I was really a good guitar player. You know, I mean, it's like, I'm like totally getting this. I don't know what I'm doing different, but I'm on it today. And then, you know, sitting down and then of course Ray, you know, he gives me these headphones and I'm like, okay, Ray, can you turn my vocal up? He goes, yeah, but you know, we're all sharing the same headphone mix. I'm like, what? What? You're sharing the same headphone mix? No. I have to have my own headphone mix. He goes, no, go with it. It's gonna be fine. You know? And I'm like, it's like, I'm going to want my vocal a lot louder and I'm not going to want the drummer to have to hear it as loud as I'm going to want to hear it. He goes, no, it'll be good for him. It's fine. He can hear it as loud as, no, you don't understand. But I've then in my codependent way, I thought, well, I'm not going to have my vocal as loud as I want it. Cause I'm not going to do that to my band, you know?
Yeah.
So then I had him turn it, you know, I got it the minimum. And then I kind of took an ear off. But what happened was because I was not listening to my voice, I was in the band. I was like the first time I ever got in a band where I just went, I'm in the band, you know?
Yeah, I'm shaking my head yes, because I know.
Some chick is singing, you know, with the from the neck up, some chick is singing. I don't know who that is, but I'm in the band, you know? And I was all about my testicles in the band, you know? I shouldn't say it that way because I don't have testicles, but you know what I'm saying. It's like...
I know what you're saying.
You do, yeah. That's right.
Even though I have a mustache.
My virtual... You know, I felt very grounded in that band. And what was so fascinating is when we come in, we'd listen to the takes, I'd be like, damn, that's a good vocal. That's really good. I should not listen to myself more often because I'm not in my head. And then I fell into the song and I lived inside the song. And, you know, the edits we did were just little tiny things. And it was so much fun. And anyway, it's coming out in 2021. And I don't know the exact date yet, but
it's fantastic. Oh, I've heard a lot of it, not the final mixes.
Yeah, we're about halfway through mixing it. And now, Ray, I may have to have Lucinda and Steve Earle kidnapped and brought to another country for a couple of weeks so I can get Ray to
I know. Listen, I've been trying to get him to do the podcast. Right. If you don't know who Ray Kennedy is, you can look him up. And he's produced me and he's produced you and but also a couple other names like Lucinda Williams and Rodney Crowell and Steve Earle and, you know, a whole bunch of other people.
And he's also an inventor. I mean, he's a
he's the mad scientist. Yeah. He's the mad scientist genius.
And he's come to, you know, my husband was, when I told him I was going to do the record with Ray, he's like, how are you ever going to get it done? Because when Ray and I get in a room, we go off. Yeah. You know how he can talk and I can talk.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh my God. You can just sit there and lose 5 hours. And what's really weird, because we talk, I mean, that hasn't changed. But for some crazy reason, we cut 17 songs in 6 days. I don't even know how that happened, because most of the time I think we were talking. So. Anyway, I love it.
I love it. Well, it's all awesome. You're awesome. We've been friends for a long time. And you live in my heart for various reasons. And I'm going to tell that story at some point.
Oh, good.
Your heart and your spirit are such a gift to me. And I'm sure to all you touch, your songs are, you know, an inspiration. I'm just grateful that you're here. And that I didn't have to ask any questions, really. I mean, in any questions they asked, forget that. We're going to talk about this. And so BethNielsenChapman.com.
Yep. And it's spelled like the Nielsen ratings, NIELSEN
There you go.
Yeah.
BethNielsenChapman.com and Facebook and YouTube and Instagram. And
also, I want to say, too, thank you so much. I'm going to make you come on my podcast. First of all, I love that you're doing this podcast, and I love the title of it and the whole in-depth kind of thing. It's great. And I'm doing a podcast in 2021 that's kind of more like I'm critiquing songs on the fly, and it's really fun. And I'll have some guests, and I'd like to have you come on and be a guest. We'll just do like a little 10-minute chat on how you.
We'd love to do that. Thing. Fantastic.
Yeah, it's called the songschoolpodcast.com. You can go there and upload a song and be considered to be on the podcast. It's going to be a lot of fun.
Songschoolpodcast.com. Yeah. Go there, upload a song. And you never know, maybe
I might be calling you, say, hey, come on, let's do this thing. And and I critique it right on the spot, you know, in live. And I love doing that. A lot of songwriting teachers don't like critiquing songs, but I find it really interesting that even if a song is really far from being done, you know, there's always something.
There's a kernel.
There's something in it that's working. And this is a human being who did this thing, and maybe there's two lines that are just like really working, and I'll go right to those two lines and go, now, this is really working. The rest of the song has to be on this level now that I know that you can do this level, you know, and they go, oh, and it's really fun to see people go back and rewrite them, and they bring them back, and then we'll put them back on the podcast with the new improved tied version of the song. So,
oh, that's fantastic.
Yeah, it's going to be fun.
That's fantastic. Well, like I said, I'm so grateful that you're here, and you've made my week. You've made, you know, I'm just happy.
Well, I'm glad we could do this, because it's a cool idea, and I can't wait to hear all the other people you must be interviewing. It must be really fun.
Yeah.
And it's really great to see you so happy. You know, I've seen you through some days that were so difficult, and you've always, you know, carried through with such strength and humanity, but it's so wonderful to see this beautiful woman in your life who's super talented. And I can't wait till we get on the other side of this pandemic so we can all have a proper dinner together. You know?
I know. I mean, my wife, Tanya Taylor Rubenstein, loves Beth Nielsen Chapman. the three name people. All Beth, right. Thank you so much for being here.
It's been my pleasure. And I'm super excited to hear this go out into the world.
Well, we're just going to keep cracking the sky. I'm gonna fly.